Welcome to our second half hour. This is Jerry Pippin. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Greer. The name of the book is Hidden Truth and Forbidden Knowledge. You are listening to the UFO Files right here on JerryPippin.com.
Well, one of the reasons why we found that that we were able to make a lot of progress, at least more so than any group had over the last 50 years or so, is because we were able to say, look, it isn't about little green men. It's about who is running the world and what are these UFOs? What technologies are represented by them? And what would the world be like? And what's the good future that awaits humanity if we could use these technologies for peaceful purposes? And I think that when people see what's at stake, they become very interested in it. This way we've had a lot of crossover mainstream interest and support in what we're doing. So I think that if you can relate this issue to something that is relevant to people's daily lives, and here, what's more relevant than the fact that the way we're living on the planet is cannibalizing it and destroying it for our children and grandchildren? You know, my grandson is turning one year old the next week, and I think, what kind of world are we leaving him and our children's children's children when we have these solutions, but we somehow haven't been able to get together on how to bring them out? And this is why I tell people who are listening, if there are people who know of institutes and funders who could get behind this energy effort, they need to contact us, because we have the immediate need right now is to put about a dozen of these top worldwide energy technologists and scientists that we have identified and vetted and who have real solutions under an engineering umbrella, and get those technologies up to something that would be a generation 1.0 version of something that could be brought out to run your house and car. That is an urgent need, and it isn't something that requires billions of dollars like we're spending to study how to clean up coal. You know, we have a $2 billion fund, a $2,000 million that we're spending as taxpayers to figure out how to clean up coal emissions a little bit. We, you know, if we had a tiny fraction of that, you could come out with the complete solution, so we wouldn't need coal at all. So now, people who own coal fields don't like that, perhaps, but the vast majority of Americans, and certainly of people on Earth, would like to see us move on to something sustainable and something that is more cost-effective. You know, a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the world can't even get electrification because the cost of putting in the linear infrastructure where you're dealing with power lines, transmission lines, central power plants, never mind the cost of the oil and the coal to burn it, is prohibitive for many, many regions of the world. And so the human race really cannot move forward until this issue gets dealt with. And this is the point that we're trying to make very clearly to folks in the political, environmental, and geopolitical world, and to just the general man on the street, because this is something that I think people do understand.
Reading between the lines here, Dr. Greer, I get the impression that you're saying that it won't take all that much of a financial resource to change this, and that the people listening, or you know, or have heard about and contacted through second, third, fourth party, just a fraction of those people could band together and really change the world.
Correct. And we already have identified all those folks. Now we have to put the support and funding mechanism in place. I don't have an extra $10 to $50 million laying around to put a serious R&D effort together on this energy issue, but there are people who do. We need to identify those people, explain the situation, and say, look, even if it was done to as a grant, I mean, if you look at what you know, the prophet from Omaha is doing, Buffett and the Gates Foundation, they're spending tens of billions of dollars really tinkering around the edges of the problems of the world. A tiny fraction of that kind of money would solve the central problem that's facing the world that's causing so much poverty and so much disease. And you're not going to fix these dynamics when you have 6 billion people becoming 7, becoming 9, becoming 10 billion, when you have this zero-sum game of fossil fuels and energy. So the fundamental solutions exist. We know what they are. We know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are. We now have to find the way to put together
maybe someone out there is going to sell their Shell stock and
that would be nice.
Give you some money and take a tax write-off in the meantime.
Right. Yeah. It certainly can be done. And I have no doubt at all at this point. I wouldn't have said this 3 or 4 years ago, but I have no doubt at this stage that we have identified the technologies and the people who understand them to put together into an R&D effort to get this done. But it isn't going to be done. You know, the level of support we've had have been, you know, a few thousand or even a couple hundred thousand dollars when we were trying to do this from mainly one or two supporters of what we're doing and mainly from myself and my own family. But to really do something like this, you know, you're going to need some serious R&D funds, and that isn't going to happen with a few thousand dollars. You're not going to put on a team of a dozen engineers in a facility with the right equipment and fabricating capabilities for $100,000. I mean, let's live in the real world here. So that's where we are now. To make this next step, we're going to have to do that, and we are seeking for people who have the right stuff, as it were, quote-unquote, in terms of their intent to do this, because we're very skeptical of a lot of, you know, we've had some people approach us and say, oh, yes, but then, of course, they want to take over the effort and then keep it secret.
Yeah, isn't that the way it works? The people that you're going to impact, they're going to try to infiltrate. To them, it's a battle.
I mean, the thing is, the way we're going to have this structured is that the people who have the funds are never going to control the strategy, period. They can't. Because even if they don't know that that's their intent, I'll give you an example. There was a man who once said to me, oh, well, you know, I can put $5 million into this, but I want a majority of it. I said, no, it's not how this is going to work. He said, why not? I said, well, let me give you a scenario. Let's say that happens, and 18 months later, we have one of these things that will completely transform the energy sector, and someone comes along from one of these large corporations and offers you $5 billion for your $5 million investment. I asked him, what would you do? And this man said, well, I'm a businessman. I'd sell. I said, no, you're a money whore, and you've just sold for 2 cents on the dollar, not even. And so, you know, there's a difference between, you know, this is something where people have to understand that when there's trillions and hundreds of trillions of dollars at stake, strategically you cannot do this like you would a normal undertaking, because if you do, it will be absorbed into an entity that will then put it on a black shelf. I mean, this is what General Electric and Westinghouse and GM and large corporations have been doing for decades. I mean, I have personal friends who have had breakthroughs in energy technologies that have been bought off by these sort of entities, and you never hear them coming out into the market. Why is that? Because these very large corporate empires and industrial empires are horizontally and vertically integrated into each other, and they are not going to let something out that completely makes redundant fossil fuels and oil and gas and coal.
Well, we urge someone, if there's someone listening that can help you out, they can contact you through your website, right?
Correct, at disclosureproject.org, and send me a note if they are serious. We will vet them and see. But, yes, well, that's where we are right now. And by the way, some of the scientists that we've identified in the last year or two are really astonishing in terms of what they have in terms of proof of principle capability. They're not at the stage where they would be something you could go out and use. And to get it from where that is today to something that would run your home or run your car is not an impossible engineering task, but it's something that's going to take some serious support. What we're saying to folks is that what has happened for decades in the so-called black budget of the United States and other countries, where we have spent literally trillions of dollars that have gone into private, corporate, covert programs dealing with studying so-called UFO technology, new energy technologies, very advanced propulsion systems. Some tiny fraction of that needs to now be put into this effort so that we get a solution out to the human race, and that it happened here in the next couple of years.
Let's talk a little bit about the UFO angle here now. How many species do you think are out there?
Well, I think there probably are thousands. How many are actually involved with observing the Earth?
Yes,
probably several dozen.
I had a neocon corporate flack write me a nice fellow, but we know where he's coming from, when he found out I was going to interview you. And he said, that guy believes there's 100-plus species out there, talking about you. They always kind of try to attack the messenger, don't they?
Well, sure, of course. And the fact of the matter is that if you look at even the most conservative Drake formula that Dr. Frank Drake came up with, it's in the tens of thousands of likely advanced civilizations that are out there. The question is, how many of them have gone what I call through the threshold of light, beyond the speed of light barrier, what I call the crossing point of light, where through not a normal propulsion system, but something that has, some would say, interdimensional capabilities, that certainly involves the ability to cancel mass effects around a material item, to travel through interstellar distances. I think it's going to be a fairly large number, and I think, quite frankly, they are working together in a concerted effort at observing and, to an extent, containing the worst impulses of humanity until we become peaceful. I don't think it's any accident, for example, that we have many, many different of our witnesses. If you go to look at what we have at disclosureproject.org and the videos, and this, we have a book of 600 pages of transcripts and testimony from colonels and lieutenant generals and what have you, that were at intercontinental ballistic missile facilities or at atomic energy facilities, where every single one of them at one point or another had UFOs observing them, and at times would even show that they could take them offline. Because I think what happened is that as we went from an agrarian society in the late 1800s to a society that had hydrogen bombs and the early stages of space travel in the 50s and 60s, that a big red flag went over Earth and said, look, this is a civilization which has a lot of promise and a lot of good about humanity, but also has, unfortunately, developed technologies that have outstripped their social and spiritual development, so much so that we could be not only a threat to life on Earth, but could be a potential threat to life elsewhere out in the cosmos. And I think that is when we began to see this huge ramping up of sightings in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I think that it's understandable because of the fact that we're asymmetrically being developed. Our society, as I mentioned, has developed enormous capabilities for warfare and destruction. Unfortunately, not a concomitant level of development of social and spiritual development to where we can learn to live peacefully together.
Yeah, it's almost like we don't want to do that.
Here's the problem. I think the majority of humans do want to do that. And I've traveled all over the world. In fact, I lived in the Middle East for 3 years. My wife and I met in the Middle East and in Israel and on Mount Carmel in Haifa that's now being bombed. And my first daughter was born there. And what I have found is that the vast majority of people everywhere would rather live peacefully. But there is this effort. I think it's a sort of what used to be called an agent provocateur. There is an effort to keep that fire burning because it benefits a relatively small number of corporations and businesses. I mean, the whole world of military effort, for example, has now become a $1 trillion a year, mostly U.S. spending, by the way, industry. Well, $1 trillion a year, I mean, that's almost $100 billion a month going into this stuff. So, you know, once again, I don't see that most of humanity really wants to be blowing each other up and killing their children and bombs and all this stuff. I think that it's a relatively small number of people. And I think, again, many of the problems that have been exacerbated over the last 50 years are directly related to the way that we're living on the Earth.
Dr. Stephen Greer is our guest. A fascinating hour, I must say, Dr. Greer. We'll be back in a moment.
House Resolution 635. This is Immortal Technique. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war in which tens of thousands of civilians were killed. We are told to look upon these deaths as an exaggeration or an acceptable loss in the war on terror. But this administration has lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, and produced phony news reports. People have been imprisoned without charges and tortured, and illegal weapons used. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation. Peace.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This is Jerry Pippin, and our guest is Dr. Stephen Greer, an interesting man for sure. We mentioned on our UFO file sightings report we'd be interviewing you, and always we get the more conservative element being more vocal to us, and for some reason that's just the way life is. And here's an email from a fellow who says, I've just read Greer's new book, and part of it is Love with the Aliens. It's all about love, like that's something terrible.
Well, people who are living, I think that there are a great many people who are addicted to conflict. And if you look at what's very popular in the UFO subculture and also what's very popular in movies and documentaries, it's the lurid, sort of sexualized content, conflict, war in space, sort of this whole, Independence Day, Armageddon scenario. And I think there's a certain element that are very addicted to that. They love the idea that maybe we'll go from fighting each other in the sands of Iraq to fighting other extraterrestrial civilizations.
Well, it seems almost that this administration is aimed that way. They've declared the property between the moon and the earth, near space, U.S. territory. We've got all kinds of funding for space weapons.
Well, I've got news for you. I have witnesses who worked on projects as far back as the mid-1960s where we had already weaponized space and had very sophisticated weapons that were in space that were targeting extraterrestrial vehicles. I mean, people are...
Were they actually shooting at them?
Yes. We've actually hit them and downed them. And so I have more than one independent corroborating witness who has been part of those sort of operations. Very dangerous, very stupid, when I met with some folks at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for the division, the so-called Foreign Technology Division, which when I met with them was called FASTIC, the Foreign Aerospace Science and Technology Center, the colonel who was there and an intelligence officer said, do you think these extraterrestrials are hostile? I said, look, given what you guys have been doing for...
They ought to be.
If they were hostile, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. The Earth would be a black cinder floating through space. I said, you folks know, that even the crash that happened in Roswell wasn't a UFO that come all the way through interstellar space and somehow couldn't fly over New Mexico. I have an FBI document that was written by a field agent to J. Edgar Hoover that's been authenticated that states that it was likely because we had some high-powered radar arrays that were configured in such a way that it interfered with the electronic guidance systems, because these ET craft are completely electronic. They're not using fossil fuels or rockets. And so they collided, and one crashed north of Roswell and one down towards Socorro. And these things have been going for 50 or 60 years, and almost 60 years now. And I think that one of the problems is that's one of the chief needs for disclosure, is that there are a lot of rather dangerous things happening, in my opinion, that are off the radar screen of most of our presidents and most of our members of Congress, certainly the United Nations and other governments around the world, that are endangering, I believe, the future of the human race, and I think are very reckless because there's no oversight and there's no discussion in an open way. And this is the vacuum of secrecy tends to create this sort of dysfunction, which I think is highly risky.
Any evidence of contact with extraterrestrials, either on a semi-official or official basis?
You know, this has been rumored for many years. I'm skeptical of that. I think perhaps in the 50s there might have been. I think that that interest. My own personal opinion is that if you look at the old movie from 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still, I understand that was really a docudrama made at the encouragement of some of the people in our State Department to warn against the sort of reactionary and xenophobic militarization of the human extraterrestrial relationship. And I think that that since the 50s, although there's a lot of rumors and rumors of rumors and rumors of rumors of rumors of sort of elaborate ET and secret government collusion, I'm very skeptical of that, and I don't see the evidence for it. And certainly, of the nearly 500 military and corporate and intelligence witnesses I've dealt with, none of them have any thing that would indicate that that's ongoing.
Of the 500 that you have experience with, all of it seems like if there is any aggression, we're doing it?
Correct. Now, there are things that have happened that I think have been misinterpreted. For example, we have a couple witnesses who were out in Minot, North Dakota, when there were somewhere between 16 and 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles that were taken offline and rendered unlaunchable back in the 60s. We have documents for it. We have these witnesses who are actually at the launch control facilities. People can read about this. These people are not anonymous. Their name, rank, and serial number in our materials. What I think has happened is that some of those things happened when the ETs were saying, look, don't destroy this beautiful planet, and if you do, you go to mutually assured destruction and launch all these nuclear weapons, we can intercept them or neutralize them. What people don't understand is at the same time that was happening in the United States, it was happening in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and we have KGB documents and accounts from people in their government from that era in the 60s and 70s where they had similar events happen. So I think what the ETs were trying to say is, look, we're watching this and we're concerned about it, but if you go to mutual assured destruction, we can neutralize that capability. Now, you could take that as an act of enlightened self-interest or even wisdom, or you could take that as interfering with our military readiness and make an enemy out of them. See, you can spin this story two ways. What I'm saying to people is that we need to step back and look at the larger human problem and look at how that might appear through the eyes of another civilization out there.
You know, I've been doing shows like this for a long time and not nearly had the contacts you have on high-level government positions and military and probably even corporate areas, but I get the unsettling feeling in the past couple of years that there's a group of these people, these so-called experts, these so-called movers and shakers that thinks we can take on these extraterrestrials in a military fashion.
Right. Right.
It's very disturbing.
Well, it is, and the thing is,
I mean, why do they even think that?
Well,
I guess that
I had a Navy intelligence guy. Well, when I asked him this question back in the 90s, he says, you know, it's kind of like dogs peeing on the fence post. It's like marking territory. He says it's dumb, it's arrogant, it's just a mindset that's out there. Now, with that said, the vast majority of folks that I've done briefings at the Pentagon for the head of intelligence for the Joint Staff, the J2 position. I've done briefings for the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the most powerful intelligence entity at the Pentagon. I've been personally there with some of our military witnesses and my military advisor. And most of these men, in the first place, don't have any knowledge of these projects. In the second place, don't control them. And in the third place, are very supportive of disclosure when they that they are being left out of the loop and that this is being run by a rogue transnational group that are literally endangering the future of the human race. So what I say to people is that remember that the vast, vast majority of people in the intelligence and military community are victims of this game as much or more so than the average American.
I've noticed just the little contact we do that people that I don't know 100% for sure, but would bet the farm on that they have security connections either with the Defense Department or some other agency. Many of them would like to see disclosure. I get that feeling.
Yes, they do.
And they'd talk more, except evidently the price is pretty high to pay. How did you get all these people to talk?
Well, first of all, we identified them over a number of years. Then we put them together as a group. And before we went forward, we had people, both high placed people in the public, but also people within the covert circle. As I mentioned, there's about half of this so-called MJ-12 group support getting this out, who have extended protection to us. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this is that none of these people who come forward with us have even gotten a phone call saying, be quiet, not one. And there's a reason for that that I don't really want to go into in an interview, but suffice it to say we've had meetings where we've put that kind of security and authorization for enforcement of that security in place. And our view of it is that, you know, they may not support what we're doing in all cases, but they need to stay out of the way of it.
We have just a few minutes left, and we are going to talk about the book when we close the show. And we do have a link here where people can buy it on the website, and some information and over to your websites as well. And they need to take time to read about Dr. Stephen Greer. It's an interesting life, and I wish, and in a future show, we're going to discuss maybe your early contacts.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because that is part of the mantle of the man, so to speak, in my opinion. But I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up CSETI. You founded that, right?
Right. The parent organization for the Disclosure Project is CSETI, and people can see that at CSETI.org. And it was started in 1990 as a interplanetary ambassador program, for lack of a better concept. I concluded that these ET vehicles were real. I concluded that they were wanting to have contact in a peaceful fashion with humans, that they had done so over many decades, and that we needed to put teams of people together. And so what we do is that we train people in what I call the CE5 initiative, or Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, where we take people out under the stars and teach them techniques and protocols for preparing themselves to make contact with these objects or with the occupants of these objects in a very broad paradigm. We're using not only lasers and electromagnetic signals, but we're using remote viewing and consciousness and some really very avant-garde concepts. Because what we've concluded, and this is one of the interesting conversations I had with the CIA director's wife, who I recount in this book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, is that she said, how are they communicating across the vast distances of space that are, you know, many, many thousands of light years? And I said, well, they're not using AT&T electromagnetic signals. And I began to discuss the fact that there's a nexus where consciousness, what we might call mind stuff, and thought and electromagnetism comes together. And it's a very interesting area of science, and it is a legitimate science. And that can be utilized for both communication and imaging of off-planet operations and extraterrestrial craft. Their systems easily interface with what we would call coherent thoughts, like a laser is coherent light. Their systems interface with that as easily as you and I pick up a cell phone. Now, I remind people, even though that sounds outrageous to some folks, if you were to show someone a cell phone 500 years ago, you'd be burned at the stake as a witch, because it would look like magic. Never mind a television camera or even a flashlight for that matter. So we're dealing with civilizations whose technologies have gone through the light barrier into these other, some would say, dimensions, but in a scientifically reproducible fashion.
Hey, do you have any kind of clue about what their civilizations are like?
Yes, we do. And that's a long discussion, but let's just say that they are further apart from how they're living on a day-to-day basis than we are from cavemen. And I think that this is why you have to avoid an anthropocentric projection onto the extraterrestrial phenomenon, because we're dealing with a whole set of values and technologies and capabilities that are quite advanced. And understanding for people to get their minds around if they're going to go out, and this is what we encourage people. In fact, we're going to be at Mount Shasta in California over Labor Day, and then here in Virginia near our farm here near Monticello, near Thomas Jefferson's home in October, for about a week at each place, so taking people out under the stars, and people can find out about that if they are interested at CSETI.org.
Good. We urge people to go over there. Sorry, our time's up. But
it was wonderful speaking with you.
And we look forward to talking to you again. And in the book, is it getting the reaction you thought it would or needed?
Oh, yes. It's been very widely supported.
Because it's not easy writing a book.
Yes, and this book was actually dictated and then had to be written from about 45 hours of oral audio tape.
I mean, people, you know, I know people read a lot of books every week. And I think that's great. And another way, from the little bit of writing I do, it's a shame that they can go through what takes hours and years of sweat sometimes in a matter of a day or two. But your book's a great read.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Greer.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. We've been talking with Dr. Stephen Greer. He's been on the line with us from his home near Charlottesville, Virginia. The name of the book, again, is Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. We'll have to have him back soon, for sure. Thank you for listening, everyone. This program was produced and edited by the lovely Jane Swartley. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin saying, cheers.